standard line, and you start to get this, either they're just deer in the headlights because they've never heard this other material, or they get this incredulous look on their face like, how could you say that? Why? Everyone knows that, fill in the blank.
Well, the mind automatically and involuntarily rejects information that is not consistent with what we already believe. It's called cognitive dissonance. And so it makes it very difficult for people to get out of that preconceived mindset that they already have, because people can be led to believe something that is not true when the information is carefully timed, presented by an accepted and respected authority, and repeated over and over and over again to establish a conditioned response. That's the purpose of programming, is to build a conditioned response in the target audience so that they will respond automatically with a preference for a particular idea or particular product. It's like, for example, most people have had this experience. Did you ever buy something and then later on wonder, why did I buy that? Or take it a step further. Have you ever said or done something and then later on wondered, well, why did I do that? Why did I say that? It's as a result of this mechanism having been triggered.
Reminds me of a sales call I once got, and I had finally said, no, I'm not going to do that. And the person came back and said, sir, I can understand that, blah, blah, blah. And I said, funny, I could swear I just said no. do you have cloth ears or something? All right, let me ask a question. Let's move this along. Assuming that it is, we have two ways we could go with this. One is to look at the dynamic of how that is accomplished, or how these thoughts are embedded in what people are seeing on the tube or hearing. The second thing would be, what type of agendas are being pushed? I mean, obviously, you could tippy-toe out to the conspiracy area here. But then again, we know, for example, that until alternative media kicked up in this country, the people that push media, and I've been in media since 65, which means 40 years now, largely have a very leftist viewpoint of things and would like to see leftist things implemented. So they can shape what people think, not just by what they say, but what they cover and what they don't cover.
Mm-hmm.
That's another process of doing it. So you're welcome to go down either trail. Just go ahead and take it.
Yes. Well, there are two primary means by which people are manipulated or controlled. One is very simple and basic. That is via the control of information that people have access to. And the other is by manipulating people's mental states. Now, as far as controlling the quality and quantity of information, there has been a long-standing trend towards the consolidation of all media into fewer and fewer hands. Back in 1983, a book came out called Media Monopoly. It was by Ben Bagdikian, former national editor at the Washington Post and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley. First edition came out and was published in 1983. At that time, 50 corporations controlled most of America's media. When the second edition of the book was published in 1988, that number shrank to 29. The third edition in 1990, it shrank further to 26. Today, we're talking about a half a dozen multinational corporations that are controlling the information and entertainment choices that the public has access to. So this consolidation of ownership allows the coordination of propaganda.
Which really means there isn't too much difference between Fox and CNN, for example.
Oh, no, because there isn't a coordinated agenda amongst them all, where you have, really, it's super wealthy people, super wealthy families that have control over the major corporations, and it is this kabong of individuals who have formed an alliance to manipulate and control the majority of the population. Secret knowledge is the basis of all power. This is how a minority ruling class is able to govern, manipulate, and control large numbers of people, and they can only do it through deception and illusion. But once that starts coming to the forefront, to public attention, then their basis of power, cracks start appearing in the foundation. And so it's a matter of educating the people to the nature of the problem so that they can become part of the solution in dealing with this issue.
It's not the issue necessarily of the fact that you have all these people in a smoke-filled back room, or that every day they dial up to find out who the phone call is about what they're going to cover and not cover. But you hire people of common mind and they will make decisions in those directions. Does that make some sense?
Oh, yes, it does, certainly. Yes.
Okay. And the reason is, I say, if you don't really believe that, there are really dozens of very important news stories that go ignored every day. If you flip back and forth between MSNBC and Fox News and CNN, the very same stories are being covered on all of these networks. And I keep thinking, now, how do you get to that point if there isn't some common ideology or something? Because, like I said, there are lots of stories out there that are very important, a lot of which are more important than the ones they're covering. And yet, from hour to hour, it's the same thing almost no matter which network you flip over to.
Yes, and sometimes you will see the close proximity of stories as far as where they're placed in the broadcast itself. Television news broadcasting is an interesting example of this whole phenomenon of hypnotic programming of the population. Because aside from the fact that the television induces a hypnotic state, there are things that are going on in the broadcast itself that deepen that trance state, such as at the beginning of most news broadcasts, you have repeating graphics, repetitive musical themes at the beginning of the program. Any repetitive pattern is meant to maintain or deepen the trance state. In the case of a news broadcast, the newsman or woman looks into the camera, directly into the eyes of the viewer, which is another hypnotic technique. The speech pattern of a newscaster, regardless of whether the individual is black, white, Hispanic, Oriental, they all have a similar way of speaking. It's a speech pattern that is similar to the speech pattern of a hypnotist that is associated with the dissemination of true factual information. In other words, the population has been conditioned and programmed to accept the format as the means of transmitting true factual information. And then the newscaster can comment silently on what is being said. The camera picks up subtle nuances, facial expression, and subtleties in the inflection of the voice. Then you have the news footage itself. I used to be a film editor. And working as an editor, it was easy to see how simple it is to change the meaning of an event or change the meaning of what someone says through editing.
Yeah, do you remember the movie Jaws?
Oh, yes.
They thought that was a throwaway. Do you remember that? They thought, oh, well, and they threw it at the editor and said, here, do what you can do with it. And she made a hit movie out of it just by creative editing from what they thought was going to be a bust.
It's all in editing. It's incredible. There was an experiment done at the Moscow Film School that illustrates the point, where the illusion of a single individual was created by joining the face of one woman with the torso of another, the hands of another, the legs of another, giving the impression of a single individual that didn't have any basis in reality, but in the minds of the viewer, that was a real person. So I was very familiar with how plastic and moldable media reality is, but even though I was aware of that, I didn't fully appreciate the extent to which we are all manipulated and controlled by media, even those people who work in it, because they've also been conditioned by this media-created culture. Back in 1980, I was given the results of private medical research investigating programming and deprogramming. And as a result of studying that material, it was a major factor in my leaving New York City, where I
the views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm going to be here tonight with our very special guest, Dr. Karen Efren of Minnesota. We're going to talk about the new legislation and the new committee action, congressional committee action on screening your child for mental health. Another step in the onslaught of dismantling the American family that's been going on for some time, and this is a nightmare dream that as a child I never imagined would happen in our country. The idea that the government would begin to determine who's got the right attitude and who doesn't, and that the government would take those who they think have the wrong attitude and begin to drug them. Well, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And Dr. Karen Efren is a pediatrician, a researcher, and a conference speaker. Her medical degree is from Johns Hopkins University, and her pediatric training is from the University of Minnesota. She's provided testimony for Congress, as well as in-depth analysis of numerous pieces of major federal education, health, and early childhood legislation for congressional staff and many organizations. She serves on the board of EdWatch, which for regular listeners to this show, Michael Chapman and Alan and Julie Quist have been guests on this show. EdWatch is leading the country and bringing to the ordinary American the truth about what's going on in our educational system. And I want to welcome you, Dr. Efren. How are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I'm looking forward to this very much. As you and our listeners know, we're doing a series. We're entitled The War on Reason, and clearly the legislative efforts to begin to monitor and manipulate our children's thinking process is about the most egregious example of the war on reason. That is, that we all have a duty to ourselves to protect, to respect others and their interests and their life, their liberty and their property. And certainly their children comes first. You know, we don't take, as a society, a person's child away and begin to screen them and manage them for their, quote, mental health at ages below five. But tell us about what Congress has done and what Congress is doing in this regard.
Well, actually, it started in 2002 with a presidential commission called the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. That was is a group of experts on mental health that were charged with examining and trying to fix the mental health system of the United States. And they met for a year and came out, or 2 years, actually. They met for 2 years, and they came out with an initial report in 2003 and their final report in 2004. And I got hold of it last summer along with some other people that were seeing it and really were amazed and shocked at what they were recommending.
Well, hang on for a minute. You say this was a presidential commission, so these were people appointed by George Bush.
His administration, yes.
For purposes of evaluating America's mental health system?
Correct.
That sounds like a dangerous combination right there, mental health and government. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Well, we're back while some of our stations take a break for commercial sponsorship with our guest Karen Efren, and we'll continue with this discussion. So some unelected, appointed group of people begin to evaluate the mental health condition of America and what this inside commission is going to dream up to solve a problem that that certainly doesn't affect the lives of most of us in a day-to-day basis as we just proceed to carry on with our lives. But somehow I'm getting a sense that what comes out of all of this is is a program that will affect all of us.
Absolutely, it will affect all of us. And when this report came out, they recommended that mental health screening was a really important thing to do. And they said consumers of all ages could benefit, and that people should be screened across the lifespan. And across the lifespan, and consumers of all ages were direct quotes. So they were basically saying that the entire population of the United States needed to be screened from cradle to grave.
Well, and that was the Russian idea.
Yeah, it really was. But they that was one of the things they recommend. And then the other thing they recommended was integrating that with certain treatment strategies. And one of the treatment strategies that they came up with, that they held up as a model program in this report, was something called the Texas Medication Algorithm Project. That was actually started in Texas while President Bush was governor, and it turns out was heavily influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. And they, instead of using tried and true drugs for psychosis and depression and bipolar disorder, for instance, they wanted to use all of the newest drugs, the ones that were still on patent, the ones that were the most profitable and the most expensive. And when one looks at those drugs, actually they don't work any better than the old ones, which didn't work that well to begin with. But these drugs also have very serious side effects, especially the antidepressants, which can cause suicide and violence. And the FDA was forced because...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Karen. We'll be right back with our audience. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with our special guest, Dr. Karen Efren. She's been describing for us how it is that this mental health system that was envisioned by, what was it called, the Freedom Commission?
The New Freedom Commission.
Everything is new. It's the new economy, new freedom. They just take the meanings of words, turn them upside down, and put the word new in front of it and try to pretend something that isn't. So this mental health system you've described has a treatment component, and this treatment component is to replicate a Bush program when he was in Texas called the Texas Medication Project. Is that right? The Texas Medication
Project? Texas Medication Algorithm Project,
right. Which is a partnership between government and big pharmaceuticals, with the idea that these drugs, which don't necessarily work, in fact have horrendous consequences, are imposed upon people.
Right.
As we take care of America's mental health problems.
Right. And the doctors, especially in the public mental health system, the people that are using state and federally funded programs like Medicaid would be required to use these drugs and really wouldn't have, and according to this list and this checkoff system, and they would have to ask for waivers when they didn't want to use them.
Now, when you say would have to use them, I mean, well, what does that really mean? I go into the doctor, or my father goes into the doctor, he's with Medicare, and a doctor says, you're not mentally arranged, and he'd be required to drug him?
No, if he decided to drug him, if he did label him as not mentally healthy, then he would have to use the drugs on that list.
On that list.
In that order.
Okay.
But he wouldn't necessarily be required to drug him.
Okay.
But still, to have drugs, you know, not only is the screening a bad idea, but then to tell doctors and to take away their clinical judgment and their discretion and say, these are the drugs you have to use, regardless of what you think of them, and if you don't want to use them, you have to beg us with, you know, a bunch of forms in triplicate to say, to tell us why. How many doctors do you think are going to do that?
I got it. Okay, well, I see that type of program working throughout the sustainable development world. In the land use context, it's, well, you're going to be in trouble unless you sign our collaborator agreement. And if you sign our collaborator agreement, you want to break from those best management practices, you'll have to beg us.
Right.
And so this is the same kind of strategic dynamic.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, it turns out that this nifty program wasn't saving Texas any money at all. And in fact, over 3 or 4 years, the dollars spent on certain drugs in the Medicaid system quadrupled. The cost of them quadrupled. And there was a TV station in Texas that did an investigative report and found out that certain drug companies that offered seed money for the research to put this plan together. For instance, Eli Lilly offered $109,000, but they reaped in Texas Medicaid expenditures over $300 million just from the sale of two drugs.
Well, that's
that they put forth.
You just call that a profit on the public-private partnership.
That's
the course of the new economy. You know, we've got new freedom and new economy, and these are perfect applications of how they work. This, though, really isn't just a dynamic of George Bush or the Republican Party, is it?
No. And in fact, it's interesting because on the one hand you have George Bush trying to, or his administration, and the drug companies trying to put forth this system and spread it to every state, either through screening or through this algorithm project, which has been exported to 12 or 15 different states already. You have that on the one hand, but you have other Republicans trying to say no to this.
Well, certainly.
And it's only the Republicans that are trying at all to say no. And even though... And it's the Democrats that are painting these Republicans that are trying to stop the screening and trying to stop coercive drugging. They're painting these Republicans as you know, fringe kooks. So it's a really interesting dynamic because you have the big business establishment Republicans, and then you have the conservative freedom Republicans, the small minority of them, and then you have the socialist power-grabbing Democrats.
So you got quite a combination between the left-wing collectivists, the right-wing collectivists, and in between are all the rest of us Americans who just want to lead our life.
Right, exactly.
And right now, legislatively, we're not doing very well, even though we comprise 80% of the American populace. You know, if we really stop to think about it, most Americans who despise George Bush don't really like the Democrats, and most Democrats and most Republicans who despise the John Kerrys and Bill Clintons don't really like the Republican.
Right.
You know, we've all got it half right, and if we just figure out that both sides are playing to the New World Order and they're playing to the loss of genuine liberty in America, then we can figure out we just got a clean house in Congress, and almost clean all of Congress, and certainly bring the pressure to bear to impose the constitutional limitations on presidential power that are intended. Because the idea of mentally screening older people on Medicare is very bothersome. But the real story gets interesting, does it not, when we start talking about children in this context?
Absolutely it does. Texas, for instance, has over 60% of children in foster care, poor children, maybe minority children, that are receiving psychiatric drugs, and sometimes many psychiatric drugs, and starting as young as at age 3. Massachusetts has over two-thirds of their children, foster children, on psychiatric drugs. Florida has 55%, and I'm getting reports from Alabama and Mississippi of over 70% of foster children on these drugs. And let me just give you one really tragic true life story of how this screening and drugging is playing itself out. Aliyah Gleason is was a 13-year-old at the time that this happened in Texas public schools. And she was a little bit mouthy, but otherwise an okay child. African-American, she underwent a drug or a mental health screening at her school and was labeled. And the school psychiatrist or psychologist said that she needed to be followed up and demanded that her parents have her seen by a University of Texas psychiatrist, which they reluctantly complied with. And then a short while after that, these psychiatrists demanded that her father take her to a state mental hospital. Well, he refused.
Good for him.
But Child Protective Services took her anyway and
wow.
took her in a police car. And she was in a state mental hospital for over 9 months, 5.5 months of which she had no contact with her family at all. She was not allowed contact with her family. She was physically restrained 26-plus times. She was treated with over a dozen different medications forcibly and without her parents' knowledge or consent on numerous occasions. And that is what is happening with mental health screening. There's another case in Indiana where Teen Screen, which is a mental health screening instrument developed by Columbia University, was used widespread in a school, and this one teenage girl had the screening done without her parents' knowledge or consent, and she came home with two different diagnoses because she answered two different questions out of the norm. And this one had a little bit better story. The parents were so angry that they led a rally against this type of screening instrument in the schools, and the schools stopped it, but they're also suing the school district and the psychiatric establishment that did the screening. And that is the kind of thing that needs to happen. But you know, this child was labeled as mentally ill just because of the way she answered two questions on a screening instrument, when experts like the World Health Organization, the Surgeon General, the authors of Psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual all admit that the diagnostic criteria upon which these screening instruments are based are subjective, they're vague, they are social constructions, they are value judgments based on different cultural expectations, and those are all direct quotes from the literature.
My, well something is afoul here, and it seems to be spreading hard and fast and in so many ways. And we're going to have to, when we get back, talk about what parents should be aware of as this system begins to spread further and further into our school system. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're going to continue to discuss through this break that some of our stations are taking with our special guest, Dr. Karen Efron. What is it? You know, we had Kent Snyder with the Liberty Committee, Dr. Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul's Liberty Caucus in Congress on our show last December, and Congress had just, the lame duck Congress had just passed what was known as the Mental Health Screening Act for youngsters. Tell us a bit about how that act operates and what it does.
Well, what that bill did, it was $20 million in the enormous omnibus appropriations bill that the Congress passed in the lame duck session because they couldn't come to an agreement during the regular session. And Ron Paul bravely, courageously stood up and said, no, we should not fund this money for the grants to implement the recommendations of the New Freedom Commission, like screening and drugging, unless there is parental consent that is written, informed, and voluntary and active, as opposed to passive, you know, we'll assume that you're giving us consent unless you tell us otherwise.
You don't learn till after the fact that your child
right.
has turned violent because he's been drugged by your school system.
Exactly. So this was up for consideration in Congress. Dr. Paul offered an amendment that said no funding unless the program requires this written informed consent. Well, in September when that bill went through the House, he offered the amendment, and it only got 95 votes. And every one of them was Republican. No, I'm sorry, there was maybe one Democrat. But 94 of the 95 were Republican. And they were all of the ones that usually understand this stuff and stand for freedom. So the appropriations bill had to go through the Senate yet, and they didn't do it during the regular session, so it came up in the lame duck session. And by then, by November, the word had started getting around about this, and Dr. Paul actually got the support of people in the House leadership, and even Congressman Regula, the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee, who had debated against Dr. Paul on the floor in September. So they had convinced all the people in the House to go for it and to write it into this conference report where the two chambers agree on what they'll all finally vote on. And then they tried to get a Senate agreement to do the same thing. And there were a few in the Senate, like Senator Inhofe.
Hold that thought for a second. We'll be right back with our audience. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with Dr. Karen Efron discussing the mental screening requirements that have been edicted by our Congress for our children through the school system. So, in summary, the bill was being battled through in the September through December time frame. There were only 95 congressmen who stood up for the for parental control over the important issues of raising their children.
Right.
And so then it passed. Is that what happened?
Well, there were a few senators that stood up and tried to get it done in the on the Senate side, Senator Brownback and Senator Inhofe and a couple of others. However, that's right. It was stalled in the Senate, and the amendment did not pass.
Okay.
And so funding went through for $20 million without any restrictions requiring parental consent.
And so $20 million may not sound much out of the federal budget, but we need to remember that when the income tax was passed, it was on 1% of the population with a 7% top rate.
Yeah.
So these things tend to grow. What we've now done is accepted the premise that a school system because they don't like your child's attitude or his values or his beliefs, can drug that child, test that child, do all kinds of things with that child without the parent knowing. What should parents be doing about this, Karen?
Well, there's a number of things they can do. On the federal level, they can still support the now standalone legislation that has been introduced in this Congress by Dr. Paul, that has a bunch of co-sponsors, that basically puts into legislation the idea of that amendment from last fall. So no funding, and these programs must require written, informed, active, voluntary parental consent. And the other thing the bill now says is that a parent can't be charged with child abuse or neglect for refusing screening.
Well, that's that needs to happen.
Yeah.
People who want to keep abreast of that can sign up for your alerts. Boy, they're wonderful alerts. If you're not on the EdWatch list, you need to get on the EdWatch list so that you know what's happening in the educational system here in America. It is changing very rapidly. How can someone get on your EdWatch list, Karen?
They can go to our website, EdWatch, that's EdWatch.org, or EdAction, EdAction.org, and that's our political action committee website. And we actually have a mechanism set up where people can just click on a link and fill in name and address and send an email directly to their congressman and ask them to support this bill. And it gives all the, you know, the letter's already written, the background information is there, all they have to do is click on it. And so that's one way that they can do it.
Well, I can't recommend getting on the EdWatch action list any higher than anything else I can think of here in the world of what Americans need to do. You know, the other list you ought to get on is the Liberty Committee. That's T-H-E,
right.
Liberty Committee, so that you get the notices from Congressman Paul, who is fighting these education issues very effectively with EdWatch and others, and of course is fighting a lot of the other thefts of liberty that Congress is routinely engaging in these years.
Right. And there is actually another bill in the House of Representatives by Mr. Klein, John Klein of Minnesota, called the Child Medication Safety Act, which says that a child cannot be kept out of school for if his parents refuse to put him on psychiatric medication. And that is another very good and important step.
But Karen, I've got to wonder about any parent who would want to send their child off and put them in the hands of adults who want to drug them.
Well, I agree. And although that bill isn't quite as strong as we would like because it doesn't mention the child abuse, child neglect, et cetera, charges that are used or the threat of those charges that are used against parents who refuse to drug their children, it is a huge step in the right direction. And a whole number of states have passed legislation prohibiting that kind of coercion.
Well, this is a very important issue for every parent and grandparent in America. So you want to stay tuned. We'll be back in just several minutes with our guest, Dr. Karen Effort.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. Policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and Earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, where we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Karen Efron on issues of screening children for mental health and how this is just another one of the toothpicks in the boat that is intending to dismantle the family. You know, when you boil government down, there's one of two forms. You're either central government around a central government, or you central government around the family. And in America, the idea was that we self-govern and that we begin that governance of ourself and in our family. And when you can find that a government school system can take your child and screen them, label them, and even drug them, you know, you begin to wonder if the family is winning that perpetual war of the state versus the family for the central feature in the governance of society. You know, clearly, Karen, the international influences on early childhood education have been growing very dramatically. Many Americans aren't aware of that. An increasing number of Americans are aware of that. And explain to us the UN Convention on the Rights of Children and the Decade on Education for Sustainable Development, which we've now embarked upon, and what that means for what it is that our children are being taught in the schools.
The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is very big on tolerance and diversity and the environment. And all of the UN declarations and agreements that have come before and since.
Well, let's define tolerance and diversity. I mean, diversity means that we're diverse by means of our ranking as members of groups rather than diverse and measured as an individual for the content
right.
of our character, as Martin Luther
right.
King would say. So diversity is really the, you know, it's the communist application of the idea of respecting people. You only respect groups and you disregard the individual. And the tolerance idea is really much the same. You tolerize what's politically You have to tolerate what's politically correct, and you won't tolerate those things that aren't politically correct. So it's really a double-edged, double-standard sense of tolerance that I sense is being taught in our schools.
Right, right. And it's tolerance for everything except Judeo-Christian ideas.
Right.
And it is cultural and religious equivalence. So that there is no reason to see our form of government and our history, even with its warts, as superior.
Well,
and the principles that we have, you know, that we believe in, that we have fought and died to protect. You know, that so many men and women have fought and died to protect. They don't matter because they are roughly equivalent to anything else. And it's frightening to see the way that is used in the context of mental health. For instance, there is a violence prevention program paid for with our tax dollars under No Child Left Behind, Safe and Drug-Free Schools part of the law called Early Warning Timely Response. And one of the early warning signs for potential violence and mental instability is intolerance for differences and prejudicial attitudes. And it says right on this Department of Education website, all children have likes and dislikes. However, an intense prejudice toward others based on racial, ethnic, religious, language, gender, sexual orientation, ability, and physical appearance, when coupled with other factors, may lead to violent assaults against those who are perceived to be different. So anybody who even thinks that you're being, or your child is being, racist, sexist, homophobic, maybe stands for the Christian religion instead of liking secular humanism or wanting to be forced to bow on a prayer rug as the Muslims do in public schools, as is happening in California. Anybody who objects to that could potentially be labeled as a potentially violent or mentally unstable person that would have to undergo some sort of therapy and potentially drugs.
Well, and I assume with the information age as it is, that the labeling goes with you, so that this then becomes part of employment records. You're a young child, but it grows with you, becomes part of your employment record.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have a scrape with the law, you've got to overcome the labeling that was put on you in the fifth grade. And what we're doing is really making sure that we have marginalized independence
right.
in our young people, and left only those who we've been able to test and prove will go along with what they're told to go along with,
right.
Recreate our society. You know, I wish I had it here, I saw a question from the SAT test this year, you know, for the audience who's not aware, so the college entrance test for the first time this year had a required essay test. And the question that I saw that was on an actual student's test was had to do with the fact that the old world needs to be changed and we need to enter into a new world. And they were to write an essay about the advantages of abandoning the past and seeking and abandoning the current and seeking a new world. And they were to write on this. You know, if you didn't give the right contextual answer, you didn't get a good grade.
Yeah.
I don't care how
That's
good
exactly.
a writer, how reasoned you were.
Yep, that is exactly the sort of thing. The Minnesota state writing test had a prompt a few years ago that asked what children would change about themselves. And children answered this, and the graders of this test actually flagged over 250 of them for follow-up psychological screening and intervention.
So, Mom and Dad, you don't know what's going on in your schools, what questions your children are being asked, and what's happening with the answers that your children give. But I think anybody who's hearing this show tonight or hears the tapes later on has got to begin to ask themselves, how dangerous are our schools to our children's psychological health?
Well, it's getting more and more dangerous all the time. There's another program from West Virginia funded by the same part of No Child Left Behind, the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Act, that actually had students being trained to observe, monitor, and report other students based on their words and actions and report them to the local police. Comprised of 3 students and 2 faculty advisors, the teams were to report incidents of racial, ethnic, sexual, religious, and homophobic slurs. So not only is it dangerous to your psychological health, but it's potentially dangerous to your freedom. Mm-hmm. I mean, to your actual physical freedom if you don't have the right attitudes in school.
Now we're not talking about circumstances where a child has engaged in activities that have caused harm to a person. I mean, where they've invaded their space. We're talking about the surmised process of what's going on in one's head. That violates all notions of the basis upon which a free society exists. And then to have this concept called the New Freedom Act. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And these types of standards not only are being pushed through national standards in K through 12, but they are being pushed to the very youngest children through preschool programs, and now are going to be, unless we're able to stop it, they are going to be, through Head Start, required for every Head Start program. They're going to have to align to either state early learning standards or the Head Start national standards, which are often one and the same, and the K-12 standards from No Child Left Behind, which are all based on national and global standards that are full of this tolerance and diversity. They're talking about gender and gender identity with 3-year-olds. They're talking about careers. They're talking about environmentalism. They're talking about diversity, and they're training children to be social activists, to protest the war in Iraq. You know, and regardless of what you feel about the war in Iraq, it's not right for the government to be funding programs and curriculum that involve little children doing that. In Minnesota, for example, children and families are supposed to lobby policymakers to get universal health care to improve children's development.
Well, they're teaching government instead of civics, and they're doing that at earlier and earlier ages. The social planners from way back have always said, if you let a child stay with their parents till age 5, we have a very difficult time in destroying the culture of the current. And so we need to get the children at a much earlier age. So what you're telling me is that the Head Start programs now are going to become much more focused than they have been on creating this kind of a collectivist mentality in the children. And of course, you know, we've had a system, we'll have the show coming soon on central banking and the consequences of central banking, but certainly one of them has been that our workforce has been able to be manipulated, requiring both parents and so many families to have to go to work just to pay the taxes and pay the mortgage at the same time. And,
right.
and as a consequence, our children are increasingly left to government manipulation.
Right. Right. And it is going younger and younger, and now, since government is not only providing equality of opportunity, which is what they maybe were supposed to do with schools, and that was supposed to be a state and local function, now we have the federal government not only providing and interfering with equality of opportunity, but we have them demanding equality of outcome and wanting to control all of the inputs into school. And that means the attitudes and the so-called readiness for kindergarten that is all of the factors that are involved with raising a child from birth to age five.
Well, what we see just in 2 weeks, last week we talked about a de facto federal zoning over all land use and showed how the federal government, working with its partners, in this case not the drug companies, but organizations like the Nature Conservancy, were swallowing up America's land. I mean, is the federal government stepping in on local and state prerogatives and consolidating the rural land holdings and natural resources across this country and taking it away from the citizens? And now what we're understanding is the federal government has stepped into the child rearing, into the educational system, and have contorted that with a mixed message about mixed messages about everything. And you know, I'll contend that what they're doing is they're highlighting who is to be the worker bees, and who are to be the beekeepers in this new system of human beings as biological resources, the emerging global sustainable development movement, which our educational system has fallen prey to, and so all of this categorizing and monitoring and molding of our children into this global village, as some politicians call it, is going to pay huge price for the entire human race if moms and dads and grandparents of today don't wake up and take notice of the kinds of things that Ed Watch and the Liberty Committee are working so hard in Washington, D.C. on. And we need to be working at home, I think. I'd suggest starting if you can and when you can, just taking the rearing, the nurturing of your children back away from the state. Have your children at home. Have them under the direction of people you know in teaching them, and create your family back. Boy, I tell you, when right. I did that, it was just the most marvelous thing I'd ever done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most parents who've done that find that experience. And when enough of us do that, we'll have a hope, not just for our own children, but really for the human race. Because when the American experiment, when the American experience is ruled dead, it won't resurrect for a long time.
That is really true, and the reason that one of the many reasons that I'm so concerned about this is that just as you're fighting with the land use issues, the education thing is so insidious in that they want to require these standards for private and religious child care systems, so that even if a parent doing the best that they can trying to avoid government control and government regulation wants to try and escape the system, if we don't say something soon, they won't have any option to do that.
Well, I know the local Christian high school just sent their staff down to San Diego for a 5-day conference on sustainability. How far can we go? and all the warm and fuzzy words came out, and all those staffers are confused, and you know, it is in the private schools, and that's why I say it's mom and dad. You know, it's the real knowledge comes from real books and not from the phony textbooks that they're forced to sit there and be bored by and have to read in school today. It turns most boys, for certain, it turns them off to learning. They have to sit there and listen to nonsense all day long, you know, when in half the time they can do 10 times the work and have it be real and productive. And it's just a matter of finding the curriculum and you know, and encouraging your child. And gee, if you can grow on your own and with the nurturing guidance of parents, you're going to be so much better off than even if you do graduate, you know, with the credits of this government school system, you know, ready to take your position as a beekeeper or a slave master in the New World Order. That's not an accomplishment that is of much value to yourself or to the society around you. And as the consequences of that begin to take shape over this next decade or two, we're going to look back to today and we're going to say these were the good old days, because these are the days when we can make a peep and flap our wing and change the outcome for what is destined to be if we don't do what you're doing, or do it in the way, listeners, that you can do it. It's a matter of getting information and spreading the information and increasingly living your own life outside of the fog that the sustainable developers have been putting on us for, gee, many, many decades. And of course, sustainable development is a term that's only about 10 years old and only now is coming into the vogue of the vocabulary of the American people. But when we understand what sustainable development is, and this whole educational program is the sustainable development program, they'll focus very heavily on the pantheistic ideas that are coming out of the New World Order's environmental movement. And our children are going to become very confused. The middle class is going to become very, very beleaguered if this direction is not changed.
That is true. I have a quote from a so-called scholar who asked the question, when should environmental education begin? She said in the third grade, the first grade, kindergarten. Even earlier, she said, environmental education based on life experiences should begin during the very earliest years of life.
Sure. Well, that conforms to the whole Dewey concept and the rest of the Fabians who've been managing and monitoring and pushing our educational system along for 90 years in this country now.
Right.
And now they're pulling the trigger.
Right.
And now's the time. We haven't said this in our website. We haven't said it in our writings. But I'll say it is the time that for those parents who can, you know, you say it's like these consensus meetings going on all over the country for this, that, or the other thing. You know, if you go to these consensus meetings, there's two reasons to go. One is to spy, and the other is to disrupt it.
Yep.
Once you participate in the process of destroying liberty, you have lost the war, even if you win the short-term battle and get a little candy for yourself in the process. And the educational system is the same way, but unfortunately parents don't know what they're sending their children into when they send them to these environmental indoctrination programs called government schools.
Right. Or sexual indoctrination programs, or, yes.
Or anti-American.
Right.
Or
history, globalist. Yes.
Yes. You know, no word ever. I mean, the number of people who come out of college who have no concept of natural law, no concept of who the great writers and thinkers through history were. You know, they know the icons of the environmental movement, and that's it.
Yep.
And for $200,000 and a lot of debt, you know, all you got is a big fog put on your mind. So it's a time for each of us individually to take seriously the real threat that is right smack in America's face. It doesn't matter who's president. You know, the program goes on. It doesn't matter who's president. The president is pushing these programs forward. It's all about internationalism. It is all about the ending of mankind's greatest achievement, which is the ideals and ideas that came out of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, you are right. You are right. But I think the only thing that keeps me going is that there are people out there like you and like others that understand this, the Liberty Committee and a few in Congress that do understand this, and even some, I will say, in the Bush administration. And every once in a while we get some contact with folks like that and realize that the battle isn't over yet.
The battle, it hasn't started yet, my dear. I think, you know, the bad guy's always first out of the gate. I mean, you can't anticipate the crime until the crime's been committed. Okay.
Right.
For a long time, people said there was a conspiracy going on. Well, today, there's no conspiracy. What they're doing is out in the open. Yeah. It's all on the web.
Very blatant.
They're in the bank. They're taking the money out of the bank. It's not a conspiracy. It's a crime. Okay.
Yeah.
More people are taking notice. Sure, they're pumping out money like there's no end. They can't do that forever. So we're a bit distracted with our propped up sense of luxury. But as that begins to fade, as more families, as more property owners, as more business operators find the consequences of sustainable development to be what they're intended to be, which is horrible, there will be more people saying, well, what about my children? What about the next generation? What are we really saving for future generations? Is it a salamander, or is it the right to a life of your own? And as people begin to catch on to that, you know, I don't care what David Rockefeller has to say about the fact that the freedom movement has no money and that their New World Order vision is just years away, you know, he doesn't have to be right because truth wins in the end.
Right.
So you had some interesting, we've got a few minutes left here, you had some interesting discussions just yesterday with congressional staffers on issues related to Head Start and this early program for mental screening?
We did. We are trying to help them understand that it is not the federal government's role to require standards for three-year-olds or zero to five at all, much less require them to be aligned to a particular philosophy, such as the National Head Start Child Outcome Framework or the No Child Left Behind standards, which, as your listeners understand, are very much aligned to environmentalist, globalist, evolutionary, fuzzy math, whole language national standards,
yeah,
and sometimes international standards.
The demeaning of human potential.
Right.
All of it adds up to that. Well, our time is about up. I want to thank you very much. I want to remind our listeners to check into edwatch.org. And Karen, thank you so much for your work, working in Minnesota and Washington, D.C., to hold them off a bit while the troops out in the field get organized.
Well, thank you so much for your wonderful work and for getting the word out, and I really look forward to continuing our collaboration and to fighting that battle.
Well, have a good evening, and we will do exactly that.
Fair enough. Take care.
Tune in next week for the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. We'll be back to talk about the permanent revolution, the rise of global socialism. We'll talk about Fabian socialism.
expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're here tonight and we're going to ask and discuss a very important question facing America today. Many people realize today that something is very wrong with our money. Precisely what is wrong remains largely undefined in most people's minds, because there has been no meaningful public debate on monetary fundamentals in this country for more than half a century. Thus, the public has been denied crucial knowledge of how our system is supposed to work and what has gone wrong. Instead, we've been fed through the schools and the media disinformation concocted by the very people who led us into the verge of trouble. Our show topic tonight is Central Banking, A New World Order, and our very special guest is Dr. Edwin Vieira, who holds 4 degrees from Harvard, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a PhD, and a law degree. He has successfully argued a brief cases leading to landmark decisions of the United States Supreme Court. He has written numerous monographs and articles in scholarly journals, and has written a book on money called The Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. It is the most comprehensive study in the existence of American monetary law and history viewed from a constitutional perspective. So with me tonight is Dr. Edwin Vieira. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am. My pleasure to be with you.
Well, very happy to have you here. This is our continuing series entitled The War on Reason. And there's no way we can address that subject fully without looking at the core of what makes a society operate efficiently, effectively, and honestly. And if you don't have an honest money system, you can't do those things that a healthy society would want to be able to do. So tonight we're going to talk about the American monetary system, and I don't know of anyone better to do that with than you. So thank you very much for being here. Let's start with the question of what is money?
Well, basically, money is a medium of exchange. It serves the function of simplifying and making more efficient transactions in society. Otherwise, your alternative would be to barter one good or service for another. And that's a very cumbersome process, because what you have to barter, you may not be able to find someone else who wishes to exchange at that moment. And money serves an intermediate role. It allows you to sell a particular good or service now, to hold money in what the economists call a cash balance, until the particular good or service that you eventually want to have comes on the market, or you find it at the price that you're willing to pay. So it's a method for making market transactions more efficient, and it's really a method for making market transactions highly rational, because as soon as you have a monetary economy, monetary prices are generated. And these prices tell people what the value of goods and services are. They tell entrepreneurs and capitalists and workers which areas of production they should go into and which areas of production they shouldn't, because of the profitability or unprofitability of those areas. So that directs resources into the areas that are most useful to society. And money provides the mechanism for doing all of that.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're back now at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira. And while some stations take a break from our broadcast, we will continue our discussion.
So let's pick up on that point regarding the nature of money.
Well, the point is fundamental that money is the mechanism that allows for what economists call rational economic calculation. It allows for the setting of prices, objective prices. It allows, through the price mechanism, for resources to be diverted from uses of less value to uses of higher value. And so it enables society to maximize production and maximize wealth if the monetary system is functioning in a rational free market manner. And there's exactly the problem that has developed throughout history, is that at some stage, some participants in the system, and usually they tend to be people who are in positions of governmental power, that is, the ability to use coercion lawfully, think that it's to their advantage to manipulate the monetary system so as to transfer wealth from the market, from people out there, common people, into their own hands or into the hands of the governmental apparatus. And that then results in what I would call a politicization of money. Money now becomes not simply a free market mechanism, but a political mechanism. And to the extent it becomes more a political mechanism, it loses its ability to function as a free market mechanism, and that generates all sorts of economic and then eventually social and political problems. And that's what we're seeing actually in this country. It's the history of the 20th century, the 19th century, the 18th century. I mean, you can go back as far as you want and find very, very significant examples of this debauchment, if you will, of the monetary system for political reasons occurring. And in every instance, it has resulted in real detriment to the societies in which it's happened.
Well, and of course, once the money becomes debauched, the other systems that rely on an honest money system become debauched themselves. And in fact, in our show opening this series, Dr. Michael Kaufman showed how the free market is being debauched through a political process in regards to America's rural lands and natural resources. Mm-hmm. So it all tends to come back together as a reflection of the legitimacy or morality even of that system of money, because that's where it begins. And we're going to welcome our audience back here in just a moment here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're here with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira, who has been describing for us how the monetary system can be politicized. And where it politicizes, terrible things happen to the society where that has occurred. And with that, let's keep talking about where we are and what this introduction has to do with America today.
Well, where we are is essentially in the terminal phase of politicization of the monetary system. We go back to the beginnings of the United States as a political entity. We're talking, of course, of the formation of the Constitution in the late 1700s, 1787, 1789, that period. And the Founding Fathers had had a fair amount of experience with both paper currencies and what economists used to call hard currencies, that is, silver and gold coinage systems. They had that experience during the colonial period and during the War of Independence. And one of the things they had learned, certainly during the War of Independence, was that the paper money system, or what they called in those days bills of credit generated by governments, was a very unstable system both economically and politically. And it led to grave difficulties during the War of Independence itself and immediately thereafter. A tremendous amount of economic instability, political and social instability resulting from it. So when the Constitution was drafted, they were very careful. And again, we have to remember that these were people who had this experience themselves. When they were in the Continental Congress, many of the Founding Fathers were in favor of using paper currency during the War of Independence, and they learned their lesson. Perhaps one of the few examples of where a large political leadership class really learned its lesson from some bad things that it did. In any event, during the Constitutional Convention, they came to the conclusion that they had to remove from the powers of government, both at the state level and at what they called the general government, the national level, what's called the federal government, at that level, the ability to generate governmental paper currencies. And they did that in two ways. They took the power away from the states to emit bills of credit, and they failed to give power to Congress, or they refused, I should say, because it was proposed, to give that power to emit bills of credit to Congress, and they removed that proposal from the table. So if you read the Constitution in light of the debate that described what went on, and certainly in light of the previous history, it was clear that neither the federal government nor the state governments were to exercise any power to generate a governmental paper currency. The governmental monetary system was to be based upon silver and gold, the unit being the silver Spanish mill dollar, so-called piece of eight. That's where the title of my book derives. Pieces of eight were the Spanish dollars that circulated in the colonies, and that was the unit with which the colonial merchants and others in the free markets were most familiar, and that was the one that was adopted on the recommendation of Thomas Jefferson. Most people don't realize that, but Jefferson recommended that during the Continental Congress, and Jefferson and Hamilton, when they were both in Washington's administration, one of the few things they agreed on was that monetary system of gold and silver coinage based on the silver dollar as the unit. So that's where the system started, and it was intended to depoliticize money, not to allow the government to manipulate what the substance of money was going to be by generating some kind of paper currency, especially a paper currency that would not be redeemable in gold or silver coin, and then to generate a great deal of that so you would have inflation, which they had seen, founding fathers had seen in tremendous amounts during the War of Independence, so they were very familiar with that. So to limit the government, to depoliticize money, the only money that the government would be allowed to use would be free market money, gold and silver coinage. And the government's only connection to that coinage was that the mints would stamp it. And the reason that they wanted to do that and allowed that to happen was because a stamp on a coin is a certification of its content.
Really, a best housekeeping seal of approval.
Essentially, that's right. It makes the coins circulate that much more easily. Then people don't have to test them in some way, chemically or otherwise, to determine what their content is. And it was believed at the time that if the government were limited to that function of taking gold and silver from the market, and in those days anyone could bring his gold and silver to the market and have it coined essentially at cost, there'd be no loss to him. The government would put its stamp on that coin. $1 was going to contain 371 and a quarter grains of silver, and they had another set of gold coins, which were called eagles, and they had specific weights. You would know, based upon the stamp on that coin, what its content was, and that would then facilitate free market transactions.
Well, those of us who believe in the institution of a legitimate government certainly would be hard pressed to argue that government doesn't have a role in weights and measures.
Thank you. The weights and measure provision is right there next to the coinage provision in the Constitution itself. So that's the way the founders were looking at it. And that, of course, had been the history of Anglo-American law going back as far as you want to go to the first time that coins appeared in Britain. So that was the initial plan. Now, there was not to be an outlawry, if you will, of all paper money. Private banks were to be allowed to generate paper currencies, because paper currencies ultimately are simply debt instruments of the bank. It puts these things out, and if people want to circulate them in the private market, of course that's their own business, and they take the risk, as it were.
But that bank has to have something standing behind it.
And if it doesn't make good on its notes, if it doesn't pay them on demand, or depending on what the terms may be, and on demand or monthly or whatever, then the bank is subject to, of course, bankruptcy proceedings or charges for contract violation or fraud or what have you, depending on the culpability of its officers. But that was to be the division. The free market might generate other forms of currency through private banks or other instrumentalities, may be subject to the laws of commerce and the laws of fraud, and the governments at the state and national level were solely performing this night watchman function, if you will, of certifying that the coinage contained gold or silver to a particular weight. Now, that's the point at which politicization begins to come in. And really it's in the person of Alexander Hamilton here, if you will, picking one particular famous founding father, he was very concerned about bringing the financial powers in the marketplace into some kind of symbiotic or relationship or partnership, political partnership, if you will, with the government. He thought that was the best way to stabilize the government, and those were the people that you wanted to be in an influential position. And the way he saw to do this was to create some kind of governmentally chartered bank. So you had the first Bank of the United States that Hamilton proposed and was finally put in. The states did the same type of thing,
but
for the same reason.
Excuse me, but basically you're saying that in an era, a political era, where the separation of business and government was very clear in the minds of most of the founders' heads, we had at least Alexander Hamilton suggesting the first public-private partnership, and it had to do with money.
With money, that's right. That's where this thing came in.
And of course, today, that's what we're seeing.
We're seeing it in many areas.
From land use to parenting to everything else, now it's suddenly a federal state or a federal-private partnership or a federal NGO partnership. So we've taken this model that began early in the nation's history of privatizing, if you will, for the benefit of some insiders. Money, we now do that with most all of our human activities as we accelerate that in this period of time very rapidly through all sectors of our society. But let's get back to the money dynamic.
Okay, well, and you see, that's an extrapolation of that idea. And the reason it came in first was the old rule, follow the money, right? This was a way of creating a partnership between rich people in the private sector and politicians. And Hamilton saw, as it were, the percentages in it, if you will. And as I say, it also occurred at the state level. Well, the first bank in the United States was highly controversial. It eventually, its charter ran out and it wasn't renewed. A second bank in the United States was put in, and most people are aware that Andrew Jackson, when he was president, was decidedly against this public-private partnership concept, especially in the area of banking, because that kind of a public-private partnership is a way to redistribute wealth generally to the disadvantage of most people in society. And so Jackson fought the second bank of the United States. Its charter was not renewed. So for a period of time from the mid-1830s up until the Civil War, there was no governmentally chartered national bank or what we would call today a kind of central bank mechanism. There was nothing of that kind. There were state-chartered banks. Many of them had very bad experiences in terms of they were run into the ground economically. So there was, in this country, the idea of separation of bank and state was still something that I would say a majority of the people were in favor of, and certainly at the national or the federal level, it was the ruling ethos of the time. Comes the Civil War, and again, follow the money is the rule. The Union Congress was facing a very serious problem. He had the secession of the southern states, this war that began. How were they going to finance it? And taxation, at least initially, was out of the question because the war was not terrifically popular politically. So they were afraid to raise taxes to the really astronomical levels at that time that they would have needed to finance the war. So they took two steps, critical steps. Number one, they generated the first governmental paper currency since before the Constitution, the so-called greenbacks. Governmental paper money, irredeemable in gold, and legal tender, which meant that everyone had to take them in trade. So that was the first thing, putting the government into the paper money business. The second thing was the creation of the so-called national banking system. This, again, was a private-public partnership, and if you read the legislative debates on it, the proponents of the national bank come right out and say that. They say precisely, this is what we're doing. We want the financially powerful people, the financially elite group in this country, to be on board with the government, to be in a partnership with us in the generation of paper currency. So they gave people, private parties, the opportunity to buy government bonds and then to use those bonds as the basis for generating their own private banknotes. So you had two streams now of paper currency coming out that were sanctioned by the national government, one directly from the Treasury, the greenbacks, and the other indirectly from the Treasury through the purchase of bonds coming out through
right
private banks.
Right back at 421 Santa Cruz to keep this rolling. back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station, and again, we're going to carry on our conversation with Dr. Edwin Viara right through this commercial break for some stations. And what we've got is clearly this combination of financial interests with political interests, and of course, the first thing we can expect that partnership to do is to fool the people by saying we're going to redistribute for the benefit of the less well-off. But who really benefits from a system of government-private partnerships when it comes to money?
Well, let's just take one more step in the history, because of course, the national banking system was not really a central bank. It didn't have a capstone to the pyramid. And comes 1913, and they created that in the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve was really the perfection of this system that found its origin in the Civil War, Union Congress legislation in the Civil War. Now, if you ask who benefits from this system, the answer is the first people in the feed chain, if you will. Let's give an example, a counterfeiter. Counterfeiter generates some paper currency, and he goes out and he spends it. Let's say he buys some jewelry or whatever. He goes off, and he has the full benefit of that counterfeit currency because he's gotten this jewelry and he's disappeared with it. At some point down the line, as the jewelry store spends that money and somebody else spends the money, eventually gets this to a bank or someone else who looks at it and says, wait a minute, this isn't good. This is counterfeit money. And then whoever is holding that money loses the full value of it. All right? So the counterfeiter is a redistributor of wealth. He generates paper currency, puts it out into the marketplace. He gets the full benefit. Some other people in that chain may get the full benefit. But somewhere down the line, somebody loses everything. Now, paper currency that comes out of a, quote, legitimate, unquote, bank runs the same way. The bank takes the money and loans it to some individual, say, business venture. He goes out and he spends it to buy cement or whatever he needs to put up his factory. He's getting the full value of that money because the market is not yet aware that there's more money in circulation today than there was yesterday. Slowly, as that new money begins to percolate through the economy, the market becomes aware of that. Says, oh, there's more money now than there was yesterday, and prices start to go up. Somewhere down the line in the chain of spending, there's some poor devil whose prices go up. He has to spend more for his normal consumption than he would have otherwise, but his wages haven't gone up.
Well, that's all of us.
Well, there are some people whose wages go up pretty fast because they're tied to cost of living escalators and so forth. There are some people, congressmen are that way, all right?
Well, but inflation is not the rise in the cost of living. It's the increase in the amount of money in circulation. We can have a cost
down
right, because we're importing cheap labor.
Right, but I'm looking at the price structure. So there will always be somebody down there, somewhere in this chain of spending, who will find his prices have gone up. He has to spend more money for the same amount of goods and services, but his income has not gone up.
Okay.
So he has lost some real wealth. He has the same amount of income, but he's not able to buy as many goods and services. His standard of living has gone down. And that's what the inflationary mechanism of banks that create new money out of nothing accomplish. They are redistributors of wealth. The ones early in the chain who receive the money from those banks, and of course the banks, because they're making an interest payment on this, right? They're receiving interest in addition to repayment of principal. Those people that are early on in the chain end up getting the full value. Somebody else pays the cost of that, and there's overall a redistribution of wealth. We can't always tell who it is because it's a very complicated mechanism as money percolates through the economy.
I want to welcome our listening audience back in full here in just a moment. We're here with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Viara. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show discussing the Federal Reserve and monetary policy in the United States. And during our last break, Dr. Viara has described how the Federal Reserve is the capstone on the system of government-private partnership with respect to money. The Federal Reserve in this country came in 1913. And he's described how counterfeit works to the disadvantage of the last guy in the line who's holding fake money, but that there are beneficiaries in between. And he likens that to the Federal Reserve System, in that money is simply created out of air, and the loser is the society that is affected adversely by inflation, which of course is most citizens. And the gainers are the first ones in the cycle of the use of that newly created money. Let me ask you this question, Ed. What's the dynamic for the Federal Reserve and its members itself with respect to the creation of this money, which comes out of the banking system? Is there
you have to remember, the Federal Reserve is a very complicated organization, and it's a pyramidal structure. You have the Board of Governors at the top. They're appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. And then right below the Board of Governors, there are 12 federal reserve banks. And then below them, as members of those federal, or stockholders, as they call them, of those Federal Reserve banks, are thousands and thousands of so-called member banks, which are private banks. They're national or state banks that are owned by private parties. And those are the folks that, as it were, are making something off of this deal in the private area, because the whole system is designed to float their currency and to provide credit to the currency that the system generates. The ultimate credit is provided by the Treasury of the United States, because the statute that authorizes the emission of Federal Reserve notes says they will be redeemed in lawful money at Federal Reserve banks or at the Treasury of the United States. So if the banks were to fail to pay, then the Treasury would have to pay. That is, the people of the United States would have to pay. So the theory here is that the Treasury has, in essence, or Congress, if it passed the statute, has in essence loaned the credit of every American to this banking cartel. And theoretically, if the banking cartel is run improperly or negligently or incompetently or what have you, and it collapses, then the full burden of the loss falls onto the taxpayers. That's a nice deal if you can get it.
Heads I win, tails you lose?
Yeah. Which, see, that goes back to Hamilton's principle of making this partnership between the political sector and the financial sector. And the financial sector was clever enough to say, well, we don't only want a partnership. We want to be bailed out. We want a guarantee that if we lose everything, you're going to pick up the loss. You and the political sector will pick up the loss. And the political sector says, fine, because the banking system enables the political sector to, as the expression goes, monetize public debt. So the government can turn around when it wants to spend for some new program. It doesn't have to go to the taxpayers and ask for unpopular taxes. It can go to the banking system and say, oh, here are some public debts that we're going to generate, and we want you to buy these public debts directly and put new money in our checking account, our governmental checking account, so that we can spend for this program or that program. Now, the average person who sees taxes increase, he doesn't like that, but the average person doesn't understand how the burden of public debt functions as against him, and how it harms society probably much more than taxes does, or the taxes do. Because taxes, you know what the burden is, you know when it has to be paid off. This public debt concept is one that constantly puts off to the future generations, the ultimate payment of the debt. That's why you can have a multi-trillion dollar debt. It's because the person today doesn't feel that as a burden. We're paying the interest on it, but the ultimate principal payment, who knows when that's going to come due, and who knows who's going to pay it. And that's the frightening part about it from a political point of view, that you're putting off on future generations a burden as to which they have had no say whatsoever. You want to talk about taxation without representation. The piling on of essentially infinite debt must be worse from a philosophical and moral point of view. Because these folks that are coming down, my children and my children's children, they've had absolutely nothing whatsoever to say, and they're going to be born into a society that will have $15, $20, $30 trillion with a governmental debt, unpayable debt.
Well, how is it that the society, and we're going to come up on another break here in about a minute, but how is it that society lost its ability to trade with straight money, gold and silver coin? How do we get in the predicament where our money system and really our future, in the political context at least, as you just described, is now more dependent upon a system we have no control over?
It was the fault of the system. All right, that's the real quirk here. It was the fault of the Federal Reserve System. You go back to 1913, 1914, when the system came into effect, passed at the end of 1913. Federal Reserve notes were originally redeemable in gold coin. They no longer are.
And we'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our guest tonight discussing the Federal Reserve and constitutional banking, our guest Dr. Edwin Vieira. And let's continue with that idea how, beginning in 1914, the system itself took away constitutional money, which you've already described.
Right. Now, remember, with the context here, we have the public-private partnership that is embodied in the Federal Reserve. And to sell the Federal Reserve to the American people, the politicians said, well, these notes that the banks will put out, this paper currency will be redeemable in gold, and the banks will be required to have 40% gold reserve for the paper currency they generate. What was not covered, however, was what they called deposit currency, that is, checkbook currency, right, which actually forms the largest portion of the so-called money supply. And the Federal Reserve was touted as a scientific mechanism to end depressions and inflationary periods, because they had a lot of problems with fractional reserve banking, especially in the 19th century, and the Federal Reserve was supposed to solve this problem.
And yet within 20 years, we were in a depression.
Well, a lot earlier than that. The first one they had was 1920 to 21, the depression that followed World War One. But the big one came in 29 through 32.
And inflation certainly has been the case perennially since its
established. Since then. Well, it comes 1932, and here, I would call this one of the great historical breakpoints, because if someone had come forward and explained to the American people that the reason they had this collapse was because of the fractional reserve banking system and public-private partnership, the problem could have been solved. And it's interesting because Franklin Roosevelt ran on a platform of a sound currency at all hazards. That's an exact quote from the Democratic platform of 1932.
Wow.
Sound currency at all hazards. Well, what he did was, as soon as he came in, he closed the banks, he seized people's gold, he went off the domestic gold standard, and he actually gave more power to the Federal Reserve than it had beforehand. So that was the first step in removing sound money entirely from the system. Now you had a currency that, at least domestically, was not redeemable in gold at all. It was redeemable internationally because you had foreign affairs problems with other countries who were going to accept an irredeemable currency. You still had silver circulating in the system, just as it had since the late 1700s. Well, that situation went on through World War II, and World War II left the United States in the premier financial position in the entire world. Federal Reserve note was the world reserve currency under the Bretton Woods Agreement. But there was a large inflation that went on in the late 50s and 60s. Throughout the 60s, of course, Johnson, with the promotion of the guns and butter program for the Vietnam War, right? We're going to spend on the Vietnam War without raising
taxes.
We're
going to be right back, Dr. Vieira, with the rest of our audience, so hold that thought for just a moment. We're back with our guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira, who has described how in the 30s, in order to save the currency on a platform pledge, the executive administration under Franklin Roosevelt confiscated citizens' gold and took us into the second depression since the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And the system of the Federal Reserve was sold to the citizenry as the methodology which would end depressions and inflation. And
right.
Of course, we've had booms and busts all along, and we've had massive amounts of inflation, which Dr. Vieira is describing really started to set sail in the 1950s. And with that, let's proceed.
Well, Lyndon Johnson's inflation during the Vietnam War period was so great that when Nixon came in, Nixon had to stop international payments of gold, the redemption of Federal Reserve notes. So you see the sequence. And the sequence was not, the sequencing was first, gold was to back the Federal Reserve note, that was supposed to give us stability. The Federal Reserve system was inherently unstable, led to the Depression. Roosevelt comes in, and instead of changing the system in the direction of stability, he gives it, makes it more unstable by removing gold domestically from the system. Johnson comes in, spends a huge amount of terrific inflation, and Nixon now, instead of taking the right action to make the system stable, he makes it more unstable by removing the international payments of gold. So now we have, on the one hand, the Federal Reserve note, which is irredeemable in gold. You could still get silver with it for a while. Johnson actually removed that, 67 to 68. So by the time Nixon has taken this action in 1971, you now have the first time in American history that there is a paper currency generated by this cartel private-public partnership, which is totally irredeemable in anything of value. All right? It's a promise to pay for which the government will pay you nothing, except another piece of paper. Well, this is a kind of unprecedented situation in world history, but it seems to be chugging along because fundamentally people don't understand the inherent instability and danger in it. And that's what we're facing now, is once you have a system that is not tied to the monetary system, banking system, not tied to the market, that has no requirement that the bank's circulating currency be redeemed in anything necessarily other than another piece of circulating currency. Now, change a 5 for 5 ones, change 2 tens for 2 fives. But you have no connection to gold or silver, as was the history of paper currencies before 1971, going all the way back to the Bank of England and even back to even some earlier banks. Now there is no anchor or limitation on the expansion of the currency system, because the banks don't ever have to worry about redeeming that currency with anything. So they can expand as much as that public-private partnership wants to.
Well, and what we get from that, it seems to me, you talked about Lyndon Johnson and the massive spending during his presidency. Well, that was in large part to make war. And yet, we move forward to today, where in large part, that extra spending that is manufactured out of the air, as you, I think you're describing it, is spent on not just war, but on buying up all the resources across this land from the citizen owners and putting it into, again, public-private partnerships with the money that is created by a public-private partnership. Pretty soon, we're all going to become vessels in a public-private partnership, it seems to me, if that pattern continues.
I would say that that's the tenor or goal of any one of these paper money machines. I mean, if you run them out to their logical conclusion, theoretically, the man in control of the paper money machine can gain ownership of all private property because he can buy it up.
Well, and that's really, if we reflect on age-old political adages, I mean, as old as Isaiah, the notion that all the people's riches can be gathered if you simply blow the boundaries and raid the public treasury. And a system of paper money allows you to raid the public treasury while you go ahead and politically blur the boundaries and gather up all the riches. And that's why citizens, going back to our conversation with Dr. Michael Kaufman, that's why our conversation ends with the notion on that subject that if you're approached as an American landowner or resource owner with a government-private partnership offer for free money in exchange for a conservation easement, you simply turn it down. It's gotten to the point where our failure, our refusal to participate in these public-private partnerships is becoming essential in order to avert victory against reason. And of course, that's what our series is focusing on.
And you notice in this system that the key to the thing is the ability of the public-private partnership group to come into the market with this purchasing power, if you will, this new money. How, if you didn't have the banking system providing this new money out of nothing, would the public-private partnership or simply the government have to raise the funds? Well, it would have to go to the taxpayers. And then it would have to lay on the table why they needed this money. There has to be a program. We need to raise so much money through taxation to do the following things. And one could imagine that most of these things we're talking about would not prove to be very popular. People would not be willing to pay the exorbitant levels of taxation to achieve these New World Order goals. But the average person doesn't understand that money is being generated through the banking system, or the way it's being generated, the consequences of it being generated. And of course, then the government's able to enter the market, or the public-private partnership is able to enter the market with this purchasing power without the onus of having to satisfy the taxpayers of the justification of the program to begin with. It's fascinating because it really undermines not only the ultimate result, but it undermines the whole democratic process, the whole process of representative government, because once you allow the government and these government public-private partnerships to be independent of having to come back to the taxpayers with some justification for what they're doing, then the taxpayers become irrelevant. Well, the voters become irrelevant. The bureaucracy is the only thing that counts anymore. The bureaucracy and the banks.
Well, here in Santa Cruz is an example of a country because our model is going across the country pursuant to the federal government's commitment to sustainable policies. But we have 400 tax-funded non-profits in this town. We have deficits at the state level, deficits at the local level, deficits at the federal level, and nobody cares. Everyone lines up within this dependency line to take the public-private partnership monies, the grant funds that are sweeping all aspects of how community living is arranged here. So it's much more than an economic dynamic for future generations. It is now to the point, as you've suggested, that the voter becomes irrelevant, the elected representative becomes irrelevant. It all becomes irrelevant because it gets a life of its own, feeding off this system of money that is handing itself out in exchange for compliance to the New World Order.
And I don't think that it was any accident, if you go back historically, that the debate with Jefferson and Hamilton over the first Bank of the United States really talked in these terms. And that was Jefferson's point, that you cannot set up this kind of a system without having these kinds of consequences. He didn't foresee what we are now experiencing in particular. But in terms of the general principle, he understood it. And Hamilton, of course, was on the other side because he wanted the particular result. I don't think he ever foresaw what's happening today or would have been particularly in favor of it, what's happening today. But he was interested in the immediate political goal of creating this partnership between the financial interests and the political interests, because he wanted to stabilize a strong central government. Jefferson saw the ultimate consequence, that government would become essentially a tool of these powerful private interests. And the powerful private interests, because they were controlling wealth redistribution, would ultimately become the governing body of the country, even though they never stood for election. And that's what we see. And the politicians now are essentially puppets. And the strings are attached back to the banking system, the financial system, and the people that are in control of those entities.
Yeah, and certainly that has its effect. People say, well, not every politician is controlled by the banking system, but it happens through the operation of the political machinery, the Democrat and Republican parties, for which you cannot get elected to their nominations without the party's money, and of course the party's money is tied to the existence of the banking system.
Yeah, I think you have to look at, I don't like the word trend, but you look at the direction in which things are going. And please don't tell me that these politicians are not, in some sense, controlled. They may not understand the element of control that controls them, right? They may not be conscious of the control. They may not. They may be, as in a sense, victims or manipulated in the same way a puppet is manipulated, doesn't understand, or a marionette is manipulated, and doesn't understand who's pulling those strings. But the fact is that they continue to propose and vote for and put into effect these programs that are moving essentially in a conveyor belt in one direction. And the direction is a direction that is, if not dictated, is certainly desired by the upper levels of the financial establishment.
Well, and I think what you've got is that one direction coming from two thrusts. You've got on one side the so-called libertarian privatizer, the public-private partner third way machinery that so many libertarian organizations propel. And on the other side, you've got the socialists behind the Green Movement. Their words sound warm and fuzzy, and they attract a lot of people who aren't socialists, but the political dynamic of the left-wing socialist and the right-wing privateer combines the same end, which is to that end which propels this funding money system toward a takeover of the citizens' property.
Well, there's another term here. It comes out to what I would call classical fascism. The fascist system, the theoretical fascist system, was based upon the concept of the public-private partnership. That's what it was. It was the alternative to socialism, in which government controls all production on the one hand, and the absolute free market, in which government has nothing to do with production, and production is all controlled by private entities. Fascism was the middle structure and said, wait a minute, we can't have either one of those. We want a system where the powerful private groups, the efficient private groups, interact in a symbiotic relationship, a partnership relationship with the government, and determine not only economic policy, but political policy. In the classic fascist system, they even had a House of Representatives, if you will, that was made up of representatives of the private entities. Right? And Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, set that kind of a system up here in this country in 1933, the National Industrial Recovery Act. If you lay the National Industrial Recovery Act down next to any theoretical structure of fascism, there's theoretical fascism, it's the same thing. Now, the funny point, or perhaps funny isn't the word, the peculiar point is, that structure is the structure of the Federal Reserve System. It's the structure of the National Industrial Recovery Act. It's the structure of Mussolini's fascist system. It's the structure of theoretical fascism. The Federal Reserve System is fascism in money. And that has spread throughout the economy because it's a driving force.
Money
exercises so much control.
And it's throughout the world.
And throughout the world. And you will see, their goal at some stage is to set up a world Federal Reserve type system. It's very difficult to do because it would generate a certain amount of instability just to create one and say, here it is, we're going to use it. Now, it has to be done in a gradual sense. The Bretton Woods system for a while had the United States Federal Reserve as the world central bank. The instabilities of the system have now made the United States Federal Reserve probably not the best instrument. You have the European Union, and now you have, of course, the Chinese in Asia. But I think the overall plan is to set up a world system, world monetary system, that looks a lot like the Federal Reserve, except it will be outside of the control of any particular country.
It'll be, again, global rather than national, extremely powerful private interests combining their power, their economic power, with the force of government on a global level.
And it will be supported by the United Nations or whatever is the body of the time and the major countries, because it will promise to monetize the debts of these political entities. And then, of course, all of these political entities will be subject to that entity in the same way. If you look at the Federal Reserve System and the terrific power that it exercised over the years, let's say, in North and South America. Why? Because the currencies of Central America, Mexico, the South American countries were really rotting vegetable currencies. They were very poor currencies. Compared to them, the Federal Reserve note currency was a hard currency. So all of those countries in their financial dealings had to pretty much dance to the tune that the Federal Reserve and the financial centers in the United States, primarily New York, called. And the same thing would be true if you had an international, global Federal Reserve System. Then the United States would be in the same position with respect to that as Argentina is with respect to the United States today. That system would then really have global hegemony.
Well, let me ask this question. Is there any place in the world that is not part of this type of paper money system?
Well, they all have paper money systems of their own, and they're all interlocked in one way or another.
The monetary system that is only backed by a governmental promise.
Yeah, no, and the answer is no, unless you go into the marketplace and look at some of these private currencies that are now developing. Go on to the internet and find places like Gold Money or e-gold and so forth, where they're using a gold unit that's exchangeable over the internet. And it is not a paper currency by any stretch of the imagination. It's an absolute gold unit. The only difference between it and the coin is that it transfers electronically.
Before we get to that, let me ask you this question, too.
Yeah.
What effect, you know, for some people, understanding the political dynamic of a paper money system backed only by the promise of government on the backs of its citizens, what besides the political and the obvious economic instabilities, what effect does it have on the social structure of a nature? In a beautiful pamphlet called Why Does the United States Need Constitutional Money, which I recommend for anyone out there, and particularly for high school teachers, because this document is the perfect document for for every 15-year-old in America to read. You know, it's something that, 45-year-olds might have a hard time understanding, but a 15-year-old with a clear mind would understand this very readily because
right.
it applies straight to common sense and pure reasoning. How can somebody get that and then come back and answer the question about the hedonistic effects of paper money in our society?
Well, we've
got 1 minute till our break.
Sure, they can obtain this by just asking me for one. Post Office Box 3634, Manassas, Virginia 20108.
Okay, that's PO Box 3634, Manassas, MANASSAS,
right.
Virginia 22110.
20108.
I'm sorry, 20108.
Just ask for the Why Does the United States Need Constitutional Money pamphlet, and I'll have one of those sent out.
Okay, well, for the listeners out there, this is something you really do want to take a look at. It's pamphlet size, 45 or so pages, and we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Diallo. We're back for our last few moments, at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Station with Dr. Edwin Diallo, and while some stations are on a commercial break, let's continue and talk about the social effects that come with a monetary system such as the United States is today. What would your comments be in that regard?
This monetary system promotes overexpansion of debt. It promotes consumption rather than production or consumption rather than savings. Rather than investment. It promotes very short-term views rather than long-term views. And the example that I like to give is this is a system that is loading unpayable debt on future generations for the benefit of essentially narcissistic and hedonistic consumption in this generation. So if you look at the irresponsibility of just that aspect of it, of essentially making it impossible for some future generation, may not be the next one, but certainly the one after that, some future generation is going to find itself loaded with a level of debt that is unpayable that will result in a catastrophe.
Well, and listeners who are familiar with our show need to understand that this is what propels sustainable development. And the projectionism, just like those who sponsored this system of money promised no more inflation and no more depression, what sustainable development is promising us is quality of life for future generations. We'll have a quality of life for future generations with the natural evolution of a money system that is responsible for sustainable development is going to lead us to...
Well, it's going to lead us to something that looks like that makes the depression of the Roosevelt era look like something a desirable state of affairs. I mean, you have a debt right now of the order of national government, right? Liabilities and so-called unfunded liabilities of somewhere between $40 and $70 trillion. Depends on how you calculate it and which economist you talk to, but it's unpayable. It's impossible of that size to be paid, which means that when the time comes for those payments to be made, there will be tremendous social consequences, and they will be consequences in the direction of unheard-of instability.
Well, so how do we deal with this beginning now, with the circumstances it is, with Governor Schwarzenegger promising to reduce California CO2 levels to 80% in 1990 within the next generation or two? And we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show for more discussion to that critical issue. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show for the last few minutes with Dr. Edwin Diallo, who has explained to us how the money system creates short-term thinking that now has rolled up a debt in this country of between $40 and $70 trillion that future generations are going to have to pay in order to redeem our consumption levels of the last century and the beginnings of this century. And this is happening while every agency of government is rapidly expanding their expenditure of funds so as to implement what I call the the new world infrastructure of the post-private property era, where you live in government housing, where resources are off-limits to ordinary human beings, where jobs are assigned and your transportation alternatives become increasingly limited as the attack on the automobile accelerates. And all of this made possible thanks to the partnership between large private interests and the central power of the federal or globalizing governments. What is it that that citizens need to start thinking about in order to make some healthy transition from where we are to where we can be?
Well, for a healthy transition to take place, you're going to have to, if not change the present banking system, provide an alternative sound banking system so that the transition can take place. There's no way that this present system is going to be able to correct itself. It may not be able to correct itself if there's a competitive system. It may just go under. Your perhaps bigger problem is in looking at the possibility that a very serious economic crunch, give it whatever name you want, right? It could be hyperinflationary, it could be depressionary, all sorts of scenarios, but a very significant economic crunch is going to occur in the not-too-distant future, and what can people do there? I suppose the only answer is to begin to... number one, people have to get out of debt. The only, quote, personal salvation, unquote, from an economic point of view, is to be as debt-free as possible. And then to look at some alternatives in the area of currency, look at some of these private currencies and some of the other alternatives, because if you have a major crunch in the present banking system, look at what happened in the 30s as a good example. Many, many localities were driven to the creation of what they call private scrip, a local scrip. But some of it was generated actually by governmental entities, local governments. Some of it was generated by business entities because the banking system simply failed. It wasn't functioning anymore. So that's one thing that people have to potentially look at as a possibility, a failure of the banking system. You look at what happened in Argentina. Not too long ago, just a couple of years ago, the banks went into crisis. They shut down. They weren't allowing people to take money out. I don't know how the average Argentinian functioned under those circumstances. You had a number of those events. One happened in Maryland. One happened in Rhode Island. One happened in Ohio about 10 or 12 years ago when the state savings and loan systems collapsed. So there are recent precedents for this happening. It certainly is possible that it could happen at a national or even an international level. And the grave difficulty is, you remember during the 1930s or some of the earlier banking crises that we had in this country, when the banks collapsed, the monetary system didn't collapse because the banking system was based upon the gold and silver coin system. All the paper money the banks generated was supposedly redeemable in gold and silver. Of course, the banks weren't able to do it, and so that's why they went under. But the monetary system was still there. Now we have no underlying monetary system. There is no gold and silver coinage that's circulating. People have it, and they put it away in the strong box, the safe deposit box or whatever. But you don't see gold and silver coinage circulating the way it circulated in this country even prior to 1933. So if you had a major national or probably international monetary crisis, this country and the whole world might very well be left without any acceptable money. And imagine the consequences from an economic point of view, and then, of course, the social and political consequences that follow from a major breakdown. You look again at the 30s, you had the economic breakdown of the collapse of the stock market, and then, of course, the banks going under in 1931 and 1932. And as a result of that economic breakdown, there was a terrific social breakdown and political breakdown. Communists, fascists, every kind of crackpot political came out of the woodwork.
Sure.
And then, of course, you had Roosevelt, and Roosevelt did more to drive this country away from constitutional government and in the direction of really all sorts of unsound. And Social Security wasn't the worst of it, thank you very much. But all sorts of unsound things came out of the Roosevelt administration. And Roosevelt was probably, how should I put this, he was probably the least radical.